Let the record reflect that the time is 3:41. Today is April 1st, 2005, and members present, Representative Crawford, Lynn, Rokeberg, and myself, Chairman Anderson. I know Representative Guttenberg, and there's Ledoux, so she is present, and Guttenberg is en route, and so is Representative Cotty. Said he'd be here by 3:45. We have three bills today, House Bill 211, House Bill 216, and House Bill 180. House Bill 211 and 216, I think we have some consensus on in terms of dialogue outside of the committee, and so they shouldn't take too long. And then we'll talk about 180. House Bill 211, I am not sure who. Oh, Heath. Okay, good, good. Why don't you come up, Heath, and we'll address that one first. I thought that was my bill for a second. I thought, man, I don't remember.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Heath Hilliard. I'm staff to Representative Mike Kelly, and I'm here to present to you HB number 211. It's a deeply complicated and multifaceted board extension bill, sunset extension bill, relating to dental examiners and also relates to dentists and dental hygienists. As I said, HB 211 most basically is a sunset extension bill to extend the this board until 2011. However, in addition to that sunset extension,
you were kidding, by the way, about multifaceted, right?
Fairly, yeah.
The committee will take that seriously, and then we'll be here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do have a blank CS forthcoming that adds about 40 pages worth of. No, I'm kidding.
I have six amendments.
There are about four other policy provisions that I just wanted to draw the committee's attention to.
Okay.
And first of all, the extension was recommended under the legislative audit, and I did provide copies of that, the bulk of that audit. Some of the provisions that I'm going to address here, though, I was speaking with Pat Davidson, and I'm sure she can testify to this effect. Some of the provisions that I'm going to present to you, though, were not covered in the audit and were a result of a joint meeting in 2004 in which the Department of OCC Licensing, the Board of Dental Examiners, and the Alaska Dental Society came together and made some agreements with respect to some of these changes I'm going to outline for you. First and foremost, implements continuing education requirements for dental hygienists, modifies the inspection period for radiological equipment used in dentistry, clarifies qualifications for licensure, and also clarifies the requirements for specialty licensure in the state. And as I said, those additional provisions were as a result of that meeting in 2004. And at this time, the sponsor and the folks that we've been working with the Alaska Dental Society have no knowledge of anyone opposing any of these changes. So with that, I'll conclude my brief statement and try to address any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Hilliard?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Rokeberg.
I noticed the which policy are you going to? Is there another witness, Mr. Hilliard?
I believe that there should be someone online. I'm not 100% sure if we have somebody online from Anchorage to testify.
Should we verify that, Mr. Chairman? So
yes, Jim, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Yeah, why don't you state your name for the record, please, and affiliation, and then maybe field some questions from Representative Rokeberg. I assume you endorse the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jim Toll. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Dental Society. And I'd like to add that the Alaska State Dental Hygiene Association was party to the meetings and negotiations that were referred to earlier.
Okay, so go ahead, Representative Rokeberg, and you can.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you could just briefly review the substantive changes. For example, in Section 2, the reason going to 700 hours a year to 14 hours per week, is that the same amount of time? I didn't calculate it. And then the continuing education, the just in a nutshell, describe the changes that they made in the substantive law for the record.
Jim, do you think you could do that really briefly, go through section by section? It doesn't.
I can give it my best shot, Mr. Chairman. I would need a calculator, but it is my understanding that the 14 hours per week and 700 hours is roughly the same. What it does is make sure that people aren't doing all of taking a long break, that they're engaged in the practice throughout so that their clinical skills remain up to snuff, an adequate par.
It's 28 hours less if you multiply 14 times 52, so
okay.
Good roughly answer. The same. That's fine with me.
Okay, so next...
The rationale was, again, that they wouldn't get 700 hours between January and whenever and then sit without the clinical skills that would be appropriate. The next one, which is on continuing education, what we are doing is what we did is lift the language from what is required of dentists and say it would be a par, and this applies to dental hygienists. So that language is what exists in the statute for dentists.
Okay. Mr. Representative Guttenberg has a question.
Thank you. You were on page 2, line 5, section 6.
That's correct.
So the language on, approved by the board and by the American Dental Association, the Academy of General Dentistry, and the American Dental Hygienists Association. Do these organizations have uniform standards, or are they competing, or is this all-encompassing of all the fields that are covered under this?
Well, in this case, the American Dental Association and the Academy of General Dentistry essentially have, I will say, uniform or comparable standards, and because this is for hygienists, we then gave deference to the American Hygiene Association, because this is changing licensure by credentials in 0832, which governs hygiene, so that this is putting, again, essentially on a par with 0836, which is for dentists. Now, I don't want to jump the gun unnecessarily, but I know there have been some questions raised. The understanding with the board is that either the board can approve that or it has been approved by one of those three organizations, and that's acceptable to the board. That's the way it is being done now for dentistry and would be done with this change.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg, follow
up. Thank you. Just on a follow-up. And as far as these three different associations and their standards of continuing education, are there other organizations out there that represent similar other facets of the similar organizations that have different standards?
Are we adopting? Not that are national in scope.
Okay, so there aren't any competing organizations or anybody else that might have a different set of standards based on a different philosophy of dentistry or dental hygiene that are recognized nationally?
No, I have to say no. I've been affiliated with organized dentistry for almost 15 years now, and I'm unaware of any.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Harry, do you have the CS forthcoming, or I'll get to you, Representative Roper.
I was just kidding.
Oh, that's...
I apologize, Mr. Chairman.
That's Josh back there.
I'm satisfied with the review of the bill and the testimony, so...
Okay,
I
don't have a motion to move out, then, unless someone has a concern?
If there's any other testimony.
Okay.
You can let Ms. Davis...
Yeah, just a question. On page 6, line 5, subsection H, has not been convicted of a crime that adversely reflects the applicant's ability or competency to practice dentistry. It just raises a question mark. I mean, can a person be convicted of a crime that is a serious felony that could be outside of this definition?
I saw that too. Jim, what do you think on that? Page 4, line 5 through 7, that subsection H, that talks about, as Representative Guttenberg stated, that the crime can adversely reflect on the applicant's ability or competency to practice dentistry or that jeopardizes safety. I mean, obviously, rape, murder, things like that would count, but how far does that go on the felony list and on the misdemeanor list?
Well, it certainly isn't anyone's intent to allow anyone who has been convicted of a crime. The thinking and rationale was that you may be convicted of a traffic offense. That certainly shouldn't preclude you from the practice of dentistry. There may be other areas that you could get yourself in trouble with the state that shouldn't preclude you from the practice of dentistry. And as I'm trying to now recall the conversations, and unfortunately these were all over a year ago, we're looking at traffic offenses, and somebody felt that was an issue.
So, like, let's say driving under the influence conviction. You have a dentist who gets a DUI. I mean, you can't pull their license through subsection H on behalf of that, can you?
That's a good question, and I can't honestly say yes or no.
Because I noticed that just like
Representative Gutman. Connected with a DUI right now, no, I don't believe you could lose your license. There could be some question depending on that as to whether you had a drinking problem, which then would impair your ability to practice dentistry. But does a single DUI constitute, and could the question be raised?
Crawford. How about Crawford first?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What would it be if somebody had been convicted of fraud in their billing practices? You know, they had defrauded Medicaid or something. Would that constitute ability to practice your dental trade?
Let me answer it this way. It certainly wouldn't compromise your clinical practices. If you were convicted of Medicaid fraud and the state took whatever action it felt was appropriate, the dental society doesn't necessarily mean that you should lose your ability to earn your living as a dentist and you're still a good clinical practitioner. I guess that would be something that for OCC licensing to address.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Roper.
I believe that's covered in subsection F above already. If there's not subject to adverse report in National Practitioner Data Bank or the American Association of Dental Examiners, clearinghouse for board actions relates to criminal or fraudulent activity or dental malpractice. So that's, I would assume that's covered there.
Okay. I wasn't sure when I read
I know.
That.
There's other provisions here. This looks like an add-on to the typical conduct provisions of any OCC license. There's usually moral turpitude, other elements, but sure. This is an add to, not a diminution of the grounds for license action here.
Why don't we have Pat Davidson come up? I know I always put her on the spot. Do you want to just give a few brief words on the bill? We don't have anyone else to testify, and Heath will stand by if we have technical questions. Pat's always good at least giving us a general idea of how the audit division feels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. With regard to the question that you have right now, no, I can't say that. We've studied that issue, so there's nothing in general.
I figured that one you hadn't.
As a result of our audit, we do make a recommendation that the board be extended for 6 years. That recommendation comes from two areas. First, we find that the board is operating in the public's interest, and the audit makes no recommendations for any improvements. And secondly, this year we had an abnormally high number of boards and commissions under sunset, and what we are trying to do is sort of smooth that out a little bit. So most of the boards up for sunset this year are given either a 4, 5, 6 year extension to try to smooth that out, so you're not considering as many boards in one given year.
Okay. Questions, Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you. On page 2, it talks about the inspection rate for dental radiological equipment, and it moves it from 5 to 6 years. I wonder if that was one of the recommendations, or did you explore that, or did this change come out of budget and audit?
Through the Chair, Representative Guttenberg, other than the extension date, none of the additional changes came as a result of the audit.
Okay. Well, maybe it's simply because it's updated. Maybe Mr. Hilliard could address that.
You can sit next to each other.
Could you repeat through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, could you repeat your question?
Sure. The on page 2, there's a change of the period of time that dental radiological equipment is inspected. Mm-hmm. I wonder, that goes from 5 years to 6 years.
Correct.
I was wondering where that came from.
Through the chair and my dealings with the Alaska Dental Society and my understanding of the meeting that they had, that was a sort of essentially a function of convenience and ease to make sure that there was the ability to have the periodic reporting or the periodic inspection period that there had been in the past some difficulty getting getting it within that 5 year period. So I'm only speaking on behalf of the sponsor, but that was kind of the nature of my understanding of the desire for the change. So
yeah, okay. Representative,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Jim.
Jim Toll here. Let me take a crack at this. There is currently an inspection system that is in place and is working. And when this was originally created, the intent was that an office would have to be inspected once every 5 years. The key change that we are recommending is the second one, the change from 4 to 5. The first one, my members tell me that there is confusion, and there has been confusion with the Division of Occupational Licensing on how you would do the arithmetic. The key one is changing that 4 to 5 so that the office is inspected, and then it has to be inspected again within 5 calendar years after the year of inspection. So if you were inspected in the year 2000, you have to be inspected again before December 31st of 2005. The change to the fifth year is critical to make that arithmetic work. The first change from 6 to 5, because of interpretations, we decided it would be absolutely without question, if you put the 6 in there, then no matter how you did the arithmetic, it would work out that an office must be inspected. It was inspected in the inspection year, and then you have 5 full years after the year you're inspected to get it done. And I'll be candid with the committee. We've had some long internal discussions on an arithmetic and decided that 6 prevents anybody from getting confused. It would probably work with 5. And my members are probably now upset with me. So the 6, there is no question in that question. The key one is changing the 4 to 5. It doesn't work now by anybody's standards. Have I answered too much?
Representative Guttenberg?
No. Thank you, Mr. Toll. We had a problem like that down here where we turn 120 into 121. My comment and my concern was changes in industry standards. Maybe the equipment is getting more efficient. Maybe the radioactive isotopes are getting smaller. I didn't know if that was the concern or the issue here. So you've cleared that up. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions regarding the legislation? Can we have a motion then to move the bill out of committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roper.
I move House Bill 211 with individual recommendations and the attached zero or fiscal notes as appropriate. Fiscal, zero fiscal note.
Any objection?
Object.
Representative Crawford objects?
April Fool.
Okay. So the April Fool objection is withdrawn, and we will move that bill.
Harvey
here. Yeah, right. at a committee. With individual recommendations and attached, looks like...
Is that the guy with the rabbit?
Zero fiscal notes or fiscal notes, but according to the packet.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Next, we have House Bill 216.
Is that something that
and
first,
thanks, or? Pat. No. Property Casualty Insurance Regulation. And that legislation... Who? I don't know where my staff went, and I'm not sure... who will assist me in presenting it. There's my staff. Josh, who's going to present the bill, 216?
The second hearing, Linda Hall will
present for that's what I meant. For okay.
Accepting the award for the chairman.
Yeah, no. We've heard it once, but for Linda, Linda, do you want to come up first to go through the changes?
Is there a CS, Mr. Chairman? Or did we adopt it already?
We've adopted the CS. No, we have not. We need to, okay. Do you move that we adopt the CS?
I can find one.
Representative Roper.
I can't seem to find the CS. Yeah.
We have a brief at ease, Mr.
Chairman. We have a brief at ease.
We got an F version. We have a, you got it?
Version Y, Representative Roberg has moved that we adopt that version for committee discussion. Seeing, hearing, no objection, CS for House Bill 216, version Y is before us, and we have Linda Hall here from the Division of Insurance to go through those changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. The CS before you that you just adopted has some changes, and I think before I actually address those changes, I'd like to, since I wasn't here for the original presentation, we had a malfunction of telephone equipment, as I recall. I would like to just mention very briefly the process that we engaged in to arrive at the language in the original bill and in the changes here. I committed to this committee in early May of last year to work over the course of the summer with a group of industry people, and that included the Agents and Brokers Association as well as both commercial and personal lines insurers to come up with a more efficient means of rate and form review to enhance our marketplace and to make it more attractive to attract other insurers. That process was a series of meetings that took place over the summer and the fall. We engaged in that same process with these changes through a series of teleconferences and exchange of information, and I believe we're all in agreement with the changes made here that make it more efficient and clarify some things that were not clear. Generally, the major changes, I believe you have what's a little chart that looks like this, sectional analysis for amendments to HB 216, and it's got blocks in it that actually go through each change by section. Predominantly, we changed things that were redundant and talked about when a filing is open for public inspection. We changed in Section 4 the word extra hazardous to unusual. None of these were substantive changes. We required some duplicate language in various sections. Probably the most substantive change came through some of our self-certification language. If an insurer uses this file and use system, and I'm not going to, unless you have questions, go into a lot of detail with that, we had a self-certification process that if there were material misrepresentations, we could take them from that form and require prior approval filing. We've made some modifications to that language to make it clear that we're looking for complete, accurate filings, but we're not interested in doing $25,000 penalties because they misspell a word or do something fairly minor. So we're trying to make this workable, and I guess I would like the opportunity to say that I'm strongly supportive of this version of the bill and of the bill itself. I think it is an improvement in our regulatory environment. We maintain consumer protections that I think are critical, but I think this allows us to have some flexibility that we did not have before. There also is in your packet a letter addressed to Representative Anderson as the chair of the committee, I believe answering some of Representative Roberg's questions from the last hearing, asking in the last page of that letter is a chart with the other states that have adopted file and use systems, and particularly some flex band pieces, give some information about filings over the last 4 years, what would or would not have qualified to be filed under this flex rating provision, and some times for a number of days to close filings. And I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you. Then you remind me of the power where the communication lines did go down on this one that day. On page 3, they talk about the flex ratings and the ability in a 12-month period to move the rates not greater than 10%.
So what line is that, Representative Guttenberg? Page 3?
Section 8, page 4.
Page 4.
So if somebody came in and raised their rates 10%, and 12 months, one day later, they raised them again 10%, would that set up flags in your department?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, while it would follow the exact language here, it would certainly set up flags. Okay. I think we would look at that. With those filings, there is a requirement for some material to justify that. I would have to say we've not had that occur, and you can see in the examples in my letter, we don't get filings normally that close together with those kinds of increases, although we've certainly had increases in excess of 10%. But I think we would certainly have a flag if we went by that deadline by one day and had another rate increase that looked like that. Right. We would probably think that deserves some scrutiny.
Then you have the ability in here to address that with an insurer. And even though they could say, well, we met the requirements in here, but you could come back and...
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, yes, I believe the bill would give us that. We still have the very broad general rate standards in force that are protection. And I believe we would have the ability to do that. It would have to be done by order. We can't just say, can't do that. There has to be substantial showing that they're in violation of the title.
And how long does that normally take now for the department to do if there was a something similar? Because they're not allowed to do it now. We're trying to give them that ability. How long would the ability to department to examine the documents that they have given you and make a decision?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we have, as you can see with the letter, different filings are different numbers of days. And I think in the cases of rate filings, they can happen quickly if there are questions. The thing that tends to slow down filings in general is if we get into a series of back and forth question and answers. Mm-hmm. Typically, a simple rate filing can be done in 5 days. Do they occur in 5 days? Not often, but yes, they do. It depends on the complexity of the filing. The longer ones are normally form filings.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, looking at the letter, thank you very much for the letter, Ms. Hall. You gave one example that the most recent number of 77 rate filings, they're closed with an average time of 40 days, but you have, it appears to be 24 of the 77, or approximately one-third, took from 50 to 100 or more than 100 days. So it would be fair to say about a 30-year, it takes at least 2 months to do a 30-year work. So that's a pretty long time, though, too. So by having the flex rate, the market would be able to be more responsive to conditions without being delayed by going through the process. But I think the most important thing is it true or not that your division still maintains the oversight over these rates? So if there's a problem or a complaint about them, you still are able to take corrective action. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Roeckberg, that's absolutely correct.
So I mean, that, I think one of the concerns of the committee was that there would be lack or failure by granting the flex rating. Your department would be diminished in its oversight, and I don't think that's the case. And particularly, in addition, the examples in the letter, those are actual examples, is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Roeckberg, those are actual examples. Right. We obviously did not identify the company.
Right,
I'd
well,
prefer
the various
not to
ones.
Do that, but you can see these are typical rate filings that have occurred since 1999 in some instances, really from 2000. These are actual rate filings.
So there are numerous times where rate changes actually decrease.
That's correct.
Another concern that these, you never hear rates going down, but they in fact do go down.
They in fact do go down.
Right.
That does not ever get publicity.
Right, because we were talking about at the last meeting we were concerned, we had, there's a 20-point band rate there, but in essence, it's a zero band rate with 10 on either side.
Through the chair, that's correct.
So, I mean, it's
anything in excess of that other up or down would require, I mean, we have as much responsibility to look at inadequate rates as we do excessive rates.
Mm-hmm.
That is a solvency, one of the solvency tests that we look at. Now, I think the intent of the bill is to speed up the process, to make it more efficient, to make it more responsive to market conditions. It's been the experience, as I understand, in states that have adopted this, that they have had, frankly, an increase in the number of carriers who are willing to come in and write business. Whether that will happen in our market, it's too soon to tell, but it allows an immediate response to conditions. I think insurers will know that they can file a rate decrease. Sometimes they're hesitant to file a rate decrease, thinking it will be very difficult to then have an increase should they warrant one in the future. This allows that to happen in both ways.
Which is a very positive thing, Mr. Chairman, for the entry of new underwriters in the state. It's always been a problem up here. It truly has in all lines of insurance. But additionally, through the chair, Ms. Hall, your division still maintains the rate-setting abilities or requirements for new producers, and if you went outside the band, so if you had a rate that was in excess of 10% one way or another.
That's correct.
So you still have that over. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And there are some lines of business that are exempt totally, for example, workers' compensation, that will be exempt from these types of, they will still require prior approval.
Linda, for the record, because we haven't had a lot of testimony, but I know I've had contact from industry members saying they're supportive, how would you categorize the support for this? Because I know it's been a long time in coming. I mean, like auto insurers, I know seem to be supportive. Quite a few groups, just so we understand, as this hopefully bill passes this year, what will that mean for industry?
I think, in my experience, I've been in this position a little over 2 years. This is one of the first items that, frankly, the agent community brought to me first, before industry. As they look at their ability to have markets to sell products, the agent community broached me with it. I do know, and I believe you brought up at one point, this is something that was mentioned in the transition report as a way to enhance industry, enhance the regulatory environment in Alaska and make it more responsive. I don't think there's any indication in anything that I see that it means we're giving up consumer protection. That is a major mission of the division. But I think industry has worked hard, not only in Alaska, but in other states, to modernize the way we do business. And in today's world of the electronic environment, it also allows that. That is another piece I guess I'll throw out as a reason. One of the things I hear regularly from insurance companies today, as they have to schedule computer time, and if you don't get in line to get your changes input in your computer system, if you miss your deadline because the department may not get your rate approved, then you're another 6 months down the road. So I think there's a stability here for a certainty that if we do this and we have it in this band and we apply all of the other standards of the title, we know our rate will be effective and we can plan for it to go into effect, whether that's up or down.
And I know NCOIL, the insurance group that legislators are members of, like NCSL and CSG and these other conference groups, I know they're supportive of modernization and have had position statements, not on this bill exactly, but of legislatures in other states passing this legislation.
NCOIL is supportive of this concept.
Yeah.
I will tell you I've also been contacted by the National Agents Association encouraging support for this concept.
Okay, good. Well, if I don't see any more questions, if we could have a motion, then we'll move this on to finance to look at the financial aspects of it in the state. Could I have a motion? Representative Roper?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that it's one of those rare moments where we can actually commit to meet a campaign pledge by deregulating government. And this is really where the consumers are still protected, but we are deregulating, meeting that commitment. And I think this is real positive. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we...
Well, hold on.
Oh,
do you want to... Yeah, Mr. Kelly. That's my bad. I didn't see that he's wanted to speak after Linda. Before you make the motion, which I appreciate, Tim Kelly,
if Chairman,
for all Alaska.
Members of members of the committee, Marcus Linden, the agency product manager of Alaska, Washington, Oregon, was hoping to testify in support of the committee substitute and the bill today. He asked me to read a statement on his behalf, but I think this bill is going so well that I'm going to forego that and say thank you very much.
Please don't.
Hope there are no questions.
Do we have a copy of it for the record?
Yeah, we'll take one. At some later time, we'll give it. Good. Representative Roper, so you make the motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute for House Bill 216, version Y, with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Is zero fiscal note. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the amended CS for House Bill 216 will move on to House Finance. And thanks, Linda. I know Linda's been very patient. We've had meetings where we've canceled this or held her till the end of the meeting and said, sorry, you can't testify, so I don't know how many hours you've sat in here for this, and I know you're busy, so it's never by intent. But thanks. Thanks for everyone's participation.
I know that
where's the governor? Let's sign the bill.
Kelly understands when you had the votes, stop talking.
Yeah, that's right. I hear you. Speaking of having the votes, now we have House Bill 180. House Bill 180 is the workers' compensation bill. It's the bill that the governor, as we talked about, we've had a lot of public hearing on this, was attempted, I think, in a different derivation of it last legislature. We've heard from a lot of industries, from insurance to medical to labor to employers to a mixed bag of labor employers to workers' comp professionals. And it's obvious the first thing I'll say is that there's no definitive consensus on anything. I've had certain entities tell me, hold the bill, kill the bill, because it's not in sync with verbatim what we'd like to have. I've had others say, move it and make it a work in progress, which I don't want to move on a shoddy piece of legislation. However, I think as a matter of public policy, particularly in the case of and the fact that we've had several public hearings, we need to at least start going through section by section the bill, or we're not doing our job. I recognize that there's an ad hoc committee. I respect that committee, but they have brought nothing and continue a dialogue with the governor's office, and I don't suggest that the governor has a perfect bill, nor do I suggest that I agree with everything in it, and I prefer some amendments for sure. But conversely, if we wait and defer our position as elected officials to this ad hoc committee, many of members whom I respect very much, I think we're not doing our job. And so I've asked Paul Lisinski to come here, and we have another hour. I'd like to go through section by section. First, I wanted to go through the ad hoc bill, but we haven't had it formally drafted. I think the substance of it we have copies of, but I'd rather go through the governor's bill, House Bill 180, and literally go section by section. No tricks, no nothing weird. Just go through it and see what people like and what people don't like. It would be too convoluted and too expansive to have members that have testified come. At first I thought maybe that's the best idea and have everyone have consensus, but that would take forever. So I'm hoping that the members of the committee have the ability to discern what they like and what they don't like for their respective industries and interested parties that they have affiliations with and agreement with, and we'll just go down the line. Representative Ledoux.
I was just going to suggest we heard the Commissioner of Insurance talk about this previous bill, how she had been working with the various stakeholders, and in the end there was a really good bill crafted. My understanding is that the governor's office is working with the stakeholders now. Why don't we just give it a couple of days over the weekend and see whether or not they've crafted a really nice bill, and then we can talk about it next week.
Well, that's an interesting idea, but that's 2 months of this stakeholder conversation that's been going on. So Representative Roper, then Representative Lynn.
Mr. Chairman, I was able to, in our leadership capacities, meet with the governor and his staff this afternoon, and the indications are that there is conversations going on with the ad hoc committee, but there is certainly no guarantee that any agreement will be made, although I know that there's progress being made. That being said, number one, the there's not necessarily an expectation of a complete agreement being made. I think there will be provisions or sections that maybe there become that may be agreements made on it conceptually. Number two, I understand that some people from that make up even the ad hoc committee may not even be available after a few more days and may be going on holiday and various other things. So the fact is that for us to wait and rely on a done deal is not realistic, number one. Number two, or number three, whatever number I'm on, as I mentioned before, it's the ability, it's the responsibility of this legislature to write the bill. We shouldn't wait for other people to do our work for us. We have a bill before us, and we need to know. And if people have objections to sections of this bill, they ought to put it out in the public record, and we ought to recognize it and make some compromises and move forward, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lynn?
Well, I just wanted to make the observation. I think the chairman said that people have certain affiliations and associations and so on, and I think I hopefully can speak for the entire board by saying that the only association any of us have or should have is with our constituents in our individual districts and nobody else.
Sure. And let me clarify
I just
that.
Wanted to,
I meant to say philosophies, and you know, we know where many of the committee members sit in terms of how they want the bill to be structured, and that's what I mean. I didn't suggest that through affiliation one vote comes one way or another. But okay, it looks like a note's been brought forth, and the ad hoc committee supports House Bill 180 as written, so I'll take a motion. Just April Fools. So, Representative Roekberg, what was your comment with respect to what you were thinking? Because we talked about this before the committee. Do you agree? I mean, he has the institutional knowledge here and has chaired Labor and Commerce a couple of times, and this is such a substantive bill. Do you agree with this idea of going section by section?
Sure. And as a matter of fact, the department's been kind enough to provide a sectional for us. If you wanted to use that or go through the bill, I'm looking for my copy of the bill right now. There's so much paper in here.
Josh can grab you one when he comes back in.
No, I don't know. There's got to be one in here.
Are you referring to the sectional compared to the ad hoc bill?
No, the new on the 180. Is that the one we were provided with? The summary.
Yeah, the summary of 2005 workers.
You could either use that, which may be a good way to start, or the bill itself. I don't know what.
That's a three-page document. And I want the committee members to understand, you may not like any section. I mean, but at least get it on the record rather than say, well, we're just waiting, and then it's 2 months from now, the ad hoc committee didn't get back to us, and then we have nothing, and we didn't do our job. And
right,
I don't want to
know what the problems are. We've heard testimony. There's obviously testimony on the record of where people have. So we need to know how we're going to make progress. I think everybody's agreed that we need a bill. It's the tie-up bill, so we need to find out what the problems are and go from there.
Welcome to the rest of your life, Paul.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Crawford.
I just wanted to mention that I do have a section-by-section analysis for HB 180 in my packet. I would hope that everybody else has that.
I don't know. As we're looking here, Paul.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
We take a brief at
ease? Why don't we do that?
Yeah.
We'll take a real quick brief at ease.
Figure out what we got.
Before we start the analysis summary of HB 180 prepared for House Labor and Commerce Committee, this is from Mr. Lisinski. We have that before us. I want to make sure everyone by a nod. Yes, 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 yes. Everybody has a copy of this. Representative Guttenberg.
So, well, two things. First of all, we're working off this summary that we got today. Sections 21, 22, 203. This right here, it's indexed.
Correct.
Then I requested, I don't know how long ago, maybe 3 weeks, a flow chart. And this is what I got from the department. Did anybody else get this?
No.
Yeah, I've got one of those.
I don't.
Okay. You got so much paper, you know.
What Josh can do, I don't want to overwork him here because we've got too many things stacking, but I can have him copy that.
Wait,
he does have a copy.
Okay. Well, Mike, and this is a very basic flowchart. I had been hoping for something a little bit more detailed, so the comparisons. Maybe
this is
Okay.
All I got to do is mention it, and they produce.
Yeah, that's right. They're working. Okay, Paul, why don't you go ahead then? And we'll go through. So we have House Bill 180. This is the one that's been discussed by many different parties over the summer. This is the one that discussed with, not the ad hoc bill. I don't want to confuse people. This isn't what's called the ad hoc recommended bill, but it's what the governor ultimately filed, 2 months ago, and this is the House Bill 180, the one we've been having the last three public hearings on.
In February.
In February. Okay, I just want people to know what we're looking at. Okay, why don't you go through, to the best of your ability, I know it's difficult, go through the bill, and what I like to do is I want member Representative Ledoux.
I just want to make sure we're dealing with GH1112/A, that is the actual...
Where's your packet?
No, well, no, I know we've got this.
I'll show you,
I'll
show you how you know that. Look at
this.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so what I'd like you to do is go through that. Then what I want is, section by section, I want analysis by the committee. So we're not just going to rush through it. I want to hear what your problem is with it. We're not just going to skate by and either not move the bill or move the bill with people not understanding. I think the best way to do it is to go section by section. And for the adamancy some of the members on the committee have had against the bill, then I want to hear your objection to each section on the record. So go ahead, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Paul F. Lasanke. I'm the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I had a hand in preparing the summary of HB 180 that you've been good enough to hand out to the committee members, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to just briefly touch on how it's configured, because I see that some of the committee members have some questions. There are 6 pages of text that are actually summary that were prepared by my division. And each one of those pages of text has a number at the bottom right that would go through 1 through 6.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, you want to make sure Representative Cotton is on the same page?
Do you have a copy here?
No, I don't.
Brief at ease, please. Brief at ease. We're trying
to. Brief at ease.
Mr. Chairman, so although this looks to be pretty thick, actually the text is 6 pages in total, and each one becomes kind of a chapter index, if you will. And I have copies so that you could compare if you wish to without having to page back and forth in your own full copy of the bill behind each one. So for example, page 1 addresses section 21. And you will see that the first page behind it, which is section 16 of the bill, is the bill page that deals with that subject heading.
Gotcha.
So unfortunately, I didn't have an opportunity to repaginate the bill. So you will see numbers jumping back and forth, simply because when you get to the bill numbers, it is the actual bill page.
Okay.
Right. So page number 1 is...
of your analysis.
Of the analysis. And just to punctuate, the analysis is essentially topical or thematic, or it's things that are grouped by effects of the bill.
Gotcha.
And I was hopeful that would maybe focus our discussions, and we could move on section by section based on things that they sought to do before we went to
it's
another.
It's better to do it that way, and I hope the committee understands. If you go section by section, and one at section 1, let's say, has to deal with section 20, it's going to be way too difficult for us to go back and forth. So he's compiled sections in a group and then has listed them by page. In this case, the first one will be protecting workers' benefits and jobs. So that, I think that's a better way to analyze it. So go ahead, Paul, for page 1, which are sections 21 down the line there.
So I have broken up the themes of the bill into 6 major areas. And as you stated, Mr. Chairman, page 1 is titled Protecting Workers' Benefits and Jobs. Section 21 of the bill, and on the left you'll see the cites to the section of the bill, then there's a brief summary of my description of the effect of the bill, and then there's in parentheses you'll see the page number of the bill. So if you wanted to check by section number or page number, it's all there. Section 21 is an important change which would empower the division director of workers' compensation to immediately shut down an employer upon the completion of an investigation that confirms that the employer fails to have the legally required workers' compensation liability insurance. We currently have a a way of shutting them down now, but it takes a more extended period, and it takes a hearing before the Workers' Compensation Board. And in the interim, if people are still working without the insurance, there's always the possibility that somebody else is going to get hurt, and we really take seriously what happens to people when they get hurt working for an uninsured employer. I know that the committee heard some pretty moving testimony from Mr. Flock just the other day about the impact it's had on his life. So as a way of trying to address that, step number one is to allow our investigator or another investigator from the department. It's not specific to the Division of Workers' Compensation, because it's not it's an inquiry into, do you have insurance? And it doesn't have to get much deeper than that. It's basically, prove to us you have insurance. You haven't shown us your insurance, the certificate you're supposed to show us. Now prove to us that you really have it, even though you failed that legal requirement. If our investigation confirms that they do not have insurance, what the Section 21 would allow our investigators to give me a call. We'll have an informal hearing, give the employer one last opportunity to bring up anything that they think we might have missed. And we're talking about, Mr. Chairman, a fairly informal procedure. I mean, we're interested, if we go on a work site and they say, well, we don't have our certificate where we should, but if you call our insurance broker, they'll confirm that they wrote insurance or that we have insurance. We want to hear that. We're not interested in shutting an employer down on what would be a paperwork violation, although we are interested in them having the paperwork as required. But we don't want to shut them down in the name of not having insurance if it turns out that they do. So the whole intent is give them an opportunity to show that they have it. If they don't, shut them down immediately.
Okay, that is Section 21 of House Bill 180 in a nutshell. Section 21 is on House Bill 180's page 16. That's the next page. You can look at it. You can read it. Mr. Paul just went through that. Are there any questions or concerns about that, Representative Crawford?
Yes,
I'm going to do this with every section.
Thank you. It's a good thing, because that was one of our concerns that we wanted addressed. A lot of times now what will happen is that a company will have workers' comp insurance, but it'll be for, say, a general laborer rather than pipe fitting or ironworking or something that is at a much higher rate or premium. Are you going to be able to shut them down immediately when they don't have the proper insurance because of actual, what we believe is fraud, for getting the lower insurance rather than what they actually need? I mean, we see a lot of fraud in our industry, people misapplying what the jurisdiction is. And that was our biggest concern about this part of the bill, was would you be able to shut those folks down?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, I think that the fraud involved with willingly misclassifying your workforce would be beyond the scope of this immediate shutdown. That would be a more in-depth inquiry and would probably have to go through those channels.
Sorry, what did you just say?
He just couldn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
My answer was that this is a basic investigation. I believe that the scope of misclassification, willful fraudulent misclassification of your insurance codes is beyond the scope of this immediate shutdown provision.
Example of what Representative Crawford said and how that doesn't apply, and maybe something, a hypothetical of how this would apply.
Okay. Well, my hypothetical is
how it would apply.
If we were on scene, it doesn't always have to be on scene, obviously, but if our investigator was on scene and they're going to say, do you have workers' compensation liability insurance, because our computer system is indicating that you don't, or we got a tip that says that you don't. I mean, flat out don't have it. That's what this is designed to address, with an immediate, if they can't prove up that they have insurance, we want to shut them down
immediately. So Mom and Pop's Burger Joint, you're checking through your records and you see Mom and Pop's I don't have a record of that. Go out and check out, and you go out and say, do you have workers' compensation insurance? Can you show us verification? That's what this is allowing for you
to
do.
So we confirm that they're going concern, they have employees that would be covered, and they don't have insurance.
Okay.
Now, what Representative Crawford is talking about is, say somebody's on a construction project or something, and they have willfully misclassified the types of workers that are on that project so that they can get a lower premium. That is, in my view, beyond the scope of an immediate shutdown like we're talking about. That was not the intention of Section 21.
Okay. Representative Crawford.
That was one of the things that we were getting at. One of the reasons why we think that
when you say we, you mean?
Myself, I mean, as being a member of the construction industry, both the AGC and workers that are involved, we're both very concerned about misclassification of workers because the premiums are
an ad hoc bill. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, and why isn't it an ad hoc bill if they're concerned about it?
There is an ad hoc bill, and it was turned in to the governor, and it hasn't been put forward.
No, according to the side-by-sides, there wasn't even a provision in the ad hoc bill.
Representative Roper is saying he recognizes you support the ad hoc bill, and he's not saying where's the bill. He's saying in the ad hoc, what we saw, that this part wasn't in that one.
Is that correct? I don't know. I mean, that's my understanding.
I didn't know that we were talking about the ad hoc committee bill. I thought we were talking about this bill and my concerns with this bill.
Okay, the only reason Representative Roper said that, because you said we. You said Alaska General Contractors, you're representing all these entities. Representative Lynn corrected me at the beginning and said, don't state that you're acknowledging affiliations. We're all our independent people. And then you're speaking on the record and saying, we. Are you representing AGC and the ad hoc committee or yourself?
It was the mouse in my pocket here. My concern.
Okay.
Not anybody else's concern. My concern.
Has Paul answered that he doesn't think that applies? I mean, that's
and he's answered my question in that this bill is deficient for that problem. It doesn't address that problem. if I understood you correctly,
Representative Kahn.
You may just ask Paul if Representative Crawford's comments are valid, which I certainly believe they are, and there's a workers' compensation claim filed, and that individual has been miscategorized out of that certain category, does it affect their benefits or any relief they may acquire or desire?
Through the chair, Representative Cotton, my understanding is the workers' compensation system would not impact the benefits that were payable to that employee of that employer. They would get their full benefits.
Could you speak up, Mr. Lisanski?
They would get their full benefits. We are not basing benefits on what premiums were collected, whether it was right, wrong, or someplace in between. So in direct answer to your question, Representative, it would not affect the employees' rights to get their benefits.
Representative Guttenberg, well, follow up, Representative Crawford, then Guttenberg, then Ledoux.
Basically, what happens today when somebody has not been paying the correct premium is that the workers' comp carrier then goes back on the employer that was misclassifying, and they collect the premiums back for misclassifying those workers. What we would like to do is make sure that each of the people that are employing people in a sector, say in ironwork or in pipe fitting, or pays their proper premium up front. That way everybody that's in that industry pays the proper or lower rate, because what's happening now is the honest employers are paying the higher rate, the $112 per hundred or $88 per hundred, while this other guy over here is misclassifying his employees as a general laborer and getting it for $24 per hundred. That was what we wanted to see, I mean, what I wanted to see addressed.
I just wanted that clear, that we're looking at House Bill 180. And I see what your point is. Then I want to bring this before we get to other questions. So it's your viewpoint that you recognize his concern, but that Section 21 is addressing something different.
Correct.
Or would you say no? The part what he's talking about is kind of intertwined with Section 21.
No, Mr. Chairman, I
amended and add what he's saying. Right. In another
I would not want to assure Representative Crawford that Section 21 is addressing his concerns, because it really wasn't designed to do that.
It's about simply making sure you have certification and the ability of the division to go on site and say, do you have it, whether it's construction or hamburger joint or whatever.
Right. What really haunts me is someone like Mr. Flock that gets hurt, there is no insurance, and there is nobody to pay him under any circumstances.
And but for the division not being able to check, if you would have checked, he would have been covered, because you would have monitored that by seeing the gap in the computer list. In that hypothetical?
Possibly, but it's not always reported immediately.
Okay, let's move on with this. Representative Crawford and Guttenberg and Ledoux are still waiting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern was to make sure that misclassification does get covered and have the same ability to shut them down immediately when you find out that they're willfully misclassifying, and this bill, this section, doesn't do that, if I'm correct.
Is that something we could add, Paul, to say if an employer has misclassified, then the division, I mean, is there language we can put in? Or is it not that simple?
Mr. Chair, you know, I would really prefer, since Director Hall is here, I think that this is actually getting into her area more typically her area of enforcement, so maybe she can clear this up a little bit.
Linda, do you want to set up with us just to, at least we can, you know, at least at the end of the day, we've gone through each section, and no one can say we didn't address it.
You want me to sit here
permanently? Well, Representative
Roper. I agree with your point that this, I think what Representative Crawford is, it's another issue. It's another topic.
My point is that it may be a section we add.
This is the place, my knowledge, addressed.
I know, but we should look at this as if there's anything wrong with the existing language. Now, if it's not, as Representative Crawford says, he doesn't satisfies him, but...
Then we'll add. That's what I'm saying.
That's this whole thing. It should be, if we're going to make any progress at all, you should say whether this is good, but it doesn't go far enough. I mean, make your point, and then we should work on identifying we need an amendment to satisfy.
Exactly.
Because we're going to be sitting here running around in circles.
I said it better myself.
Representative Guttenberg.
So, I thought that's what you said.
I thought it was, too.
I think the next question should have been, is that issue addressed anywhere else in the bill?
Or in law now.
And then when we get there, we can come back to it.
Or what do you do now?
So
we'll probably say that with each section.
So, yeah, so let me ask that question, and then I can get on.
By the way, a note was passed to me, Representative Crawford, for a nutrageous. Can Representative Roper, it has a Three Musketeers bar.
Three Musketeers.
We can still make this fun. Okay. Mr. I almost called you representative. Okay, first,
Mr. Chair, if I may,
if I may just
address the first question before I swing it over to Director Hall. It is currently illegal to knowingly misclassify employees or engage in deceptive leasing practices for the purpose of evading full payment of workers' compensation insurance premiums. That's under Section 250. There are some changes through the chair to Representative Guttenberg. There are some additional changes in the bill to Section 250, but it is already illegal. And the question that I would submit might want to be addressed by Director Hall is how we go about enforcing that. But this is, Section 21 was designed to take something that we know is illegal, that is not having any insurance, and come up with a better way of shutting people down immediately when they don't have it. It was not designed to shut somebody down immediately for what, in my view, is a more complicated investigation of whether their workers have been properly classified. It's not as easy to determine by my folks. I don't know how does it, and I'd like to turn it over.
And I just, out of fairness to Paul, Representative Crawford, he can't be any more succinct. I mean, you're welcome to ask questions, but I don't know how much more you want him on the record, under oath, however you want to say it, to say this doesn't apply to that in his knowledge. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And he answered it perfectly. The way this is written,
it doesn't cover it, I want to make sure that it is covered.
Okay.
That he has the same ability to shut somebody down for willfully misclassifying. It may be a little bit more complicated. I don't want him to go and not be sure. I want him to be sure before he shuts somebody down.
Sure.
But I want him to have that power, because I know that it's going out there every day, and it's making the honest contractors pay a lot more, and the dishonest contractors are skating. But if they don't get somebody hurt, they'll go through years without ever having any recourse.
Okay, and so Director Hall, how can we fix this, and what's your response to that?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford. I mean, I'm not using director, okay? You're Paul.
Yeah, that's fine. Let's go by first names. With me, you can use my middle name, Torgny.
It's currently illegal under the work comp statutes. It is also considered premium fraud under the insurance statutes, and we have investigators. We certainly do not have this kind of tool to shut anybody down. We have currently more extensive fraud investigation authority than does the Division of Workers' Compensation, and I have 4 fraud investigators. Mm-hmm. And we try to find that, and we have not received a lot of concrete evidence to prove that. We do have the ability to do some criminal even allegations against people who willfully misclassify, but we certainly don't have, as you're suggesting, the ability to shut them down. And you know, I think that is a penalty phase that could be added if it's the desire of the body.
Okay, Representative Crawford.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. I know that this year, a man that we have tried to get shut down or at least charged the right amount of workers' comp benefits. This year, a man died on his job. It wasn't brought out until after he died that he was classifying the man as a general laborer when he was doing ironwork. That's the reason why, you know, we want to see something where you have the power to go out and shut one of these guys down, or many of these guys down that are doing such stuff as this. And we want to make it safer for Alaska workers to work. That's, I said we again. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. I meant I.
We workers.
Okay. Yeah. Let's expedite this now, because I hope people aren't being purposely dilatory, and I'm starting to feel that way. This is fairly simple. Your points are well taken, and I actually agree with you, and I want to look at a way to amend this. They've said this doesn't apply to that. So you're happy to ask questions, but don't push it. All of us, because I mean, now we've been 15 minutes on a fairly simple section. Representative Guttenberg, then Representative Leduc.
Thank you. And I just let to remind you that those of us on this inside here have been patiently
agreed.
Waiting while hands have been
that was
raised,
more directed to the left.
Well, I'm still on the same point, and I say the word we because I mean us. A responsibility to the people and the contractors of this state to make sure that mom and pop burgers doesn't from Phoenix, Arizona, doesn't bid on a bridge job and get it and get insurance rates to cover burgers, and that Pops Bridge Builders has to pay rates for iron workers and pile bucks and loses the contract to Mom's Burgers. I mean, I think that is a responsibility that we have. So my question is, you said that if somebody is misclassified, that as far as you're concerned, they are still eligible for compensation as whatever they were actually working. But what happens to the worker when they file for workers' comp and the insurance company says, you're not an iron worker, you're supposed to be flipping burgers, we're not covering you, and that person sitting in the hospital and not getting compensated? Because we've heard that here before. Especially with the fire, you know, similar thing with the firefighters, where there's a fight over who's paying or how they're paying for it. So how does that affect that worker? Because that's really what needs to happen, is that for the person that's injured, it needs to be seamless.
Through the chair, Representative Anderson, Representative Guttenberg. The insurance policy is not classification specific as regards to coverage. The workers' compensation insurance policy is basically says we'll cover the benefits that are required by the statute. It doesn't only, it's not limited to the classifications. There should be no question if the employer has coverage and the employee is injured, he will receive statutory benefits under that policy, even if the employer has misclassified him. The examples you're talking about, and it's one of the reasons it happens in my mind, and this is editorializing, is that we do have the situation you've described, and I've had people talk to me about it for a very long time, but they know that injured worker, if the policy is written for clerical employees, the truck driver covered under there will be eligible for full workers' compensation benefits as provided. The penalty becomes after the fact, as Representative Crawford has indicated, where now we have an injury, the company looks at the policy and the employer has misclassified, they will go back and retroactively charge the premium correctly, but it should never impact the benefits that the worker receives.
Thank you. And my original question was, we'll get you. The good contractor, we're actually dealing with some of these things that have to do with the bad contractor and the bad employee. Is there anything in here that says when there's a change of policy that the carrier notifies the state? I mean, if you're a contractor, you've got office workers bidding on a project, you're doing the mock-ups and the layouts and the cost estimates, and then you go into construction. Well, the rate should change at that. The number of employees goes up, number of equipment. Then at the end of the project, it goes back down to just engineering reports and as-builts. But is there anything that says that the contractor does, not the contractor, but the insurer notifies the division if there's a significant change? Because what I'm more worried about is that you approach somebody and they show you a certificate of coverage, and then the next day they cancel it.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, they are required, an insurance company is required to give the Division of Workers' Compensation notification that they have canceled a policy. And the cancellation does not become effective until a number of days after it's received by the Division of Workers' Compensation.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Ledoux.
Okay, I don't want to belabor this point, but I know that from my experience dealing with insurance law, that if one fraudulently obtains a policy, that the insurance company can generally avoid coverage. Is there something specifically in workers' comp law that doesn't allow them to do that?
I don't want to say unequivocally without doing a little more research, which I'll be happy to do. I don't normally, in order to cancel a policy for fraud, even under our statutes of any kind, you have to give notice. There's only one type of policy I know, and there have been lawsuits regarding that can be retroactively canceled because of fraud, and that tends to be in marine coverages, where you have a requirement for a survey, the survey was falsified, that's considered fraud, and coverage is canceled back retroactively. Typically, you have to, even in fraud, misrepresentation on application, give. It's a lesser notice, but there still has to be notice of cancellation. I have not ever seen in a workers' compensation policy an ability to cancel for that kind of fraud, Representative Ledoux.
And I've dealt with a maritime aspect, and I know that in the maritime field, that even a negligent misrepresentation, not a willful misrepresentation, but a negligent misrepresentation will vitiate coverage. And that's always been in the maritime cases, they talk about that being the difference. In a willful case, even on land, it was my understanding that an insurance policy could be retroactively eliminated. And what would happen, for example, you point out that somebody goes back and gets the premium. Well, if somebody has gone out of business, and they can't get the premium there. So I guess I'm just curious as to whether or not that, whether it is seamless.
I've never seen an instance of that. As I said, I will research a little more. But I think in the case, whether you can go back and collect the premium or not, one, it doesn't negate the liability that is the employer's ultimate liability for that injury in workers' compensation. The insurance company provides the coverage for that. And so the employer would still have the liability, but I will do more research on that particular topic for you because I don't want to speak without making sure I know what I'm talking about.
Thank you.
Just a comment. Somebody has been in contact with my office, not recently, but about a year and a half ago, with exactly that situation, that they got caught in something and they ended up having no insurance.
But was it workers' compensation? I mean, because I do know that what Representative Ledoux is talking about does occur in the maritime. And maritime policies are different.
Well, there was also fraud involved, and the worker was just caught in the middle.
Okay, so we have gone now through Section 21. I think I've been fairly liberal in questions and analysis on this. And it's been stated by Paul and by Linda that it doesn't affect what Representative Crawford is discussing, but we've agreed that we want to revisit his issue and see if we can't fit that in some place. Linda,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Boy, Harry, what? I'm getting frustrated.
I'm getting frustrated, too.
In what context?
Every time you mentioned this, you said, this doesn't apply, and this is exactly the situation that I'm talking about. This bill does not cover it. I mean, it doesn't address it.
How many more times do you want him to say it doesn't address what you're talking about? And we'll have to go to that in another section.
To say that this is the section where it should apply, I mean, and it doesn't. It's deficient. So, I mean, I want to amend the bill at some point or amend whatever bill that goes forward to make sure that it does apply, but... This is the area. We're not talking about something. I mean, we're not talking about apples and oranges here. They're all the same apples. I mean, if I'm wrong, then maybe they could tell us that I'm wrong.
Well, then why don't you, while we're on Section 21, give me some language that you think will fix what you're talking about, and we'll go through that right now. We'll do the work right now, rather than delay again every meeting. Weird.
Employer is determined to have willfully...
Take your time. I can take in at ease if you want to.
...misclassified direction...
While you're looking, Paul, why don't we discuss... We'll have Paul... Where in this section...
Mr. Chairman, I can read it since I wrote it.
Okay.
I think.
Representative Lynn.
A conceptual amendment to that.
Sure.
If an employer is determined to have willfully misclassified... an employee, the director may issue an immediate stop order to the employer.
Okay, now let's work with that, Paul, just for the sake of...
I could barely read it, I got to admit, even though I wrote it.
You understand Representative Crawford's point, I think. You articulated it earlier.
Was it an objection to the amendment?
Well, that's not an amendment yet because we have to draft it properly, or it's going to be real difficult for the... That's your conceptual amendment?
You asked for an amendment.
No, I'm saying let's craft an amendment that fits what Representative Crawford, it sounds like you're in sync with him, would like.
And also, where it empowers the board to find uninsured employees or misclassified employers up to $1,000 a day per employee. I'd like that in there as well, but you know I don't want to hold you up anymore. I just wanted to get the verbiage correct here. This is what I'm talking about. It's not apples and oranges. These are the same apples as I was saying, but I'm not trying to stop this proceeding. I want it to go on. I want to listen to everything they have to say.
Okay, then what I would recommend...
I will withdraw the amendment, which you didn't think I made. Even though I did make the amendment, I'll still withdraw the amendment with the option to perhaps offer it at a later time during the hearing.
And that sounds good. Why don't we move on to Section 21, and you can craft that if you want to try to craft that while we're moving on to Section 22. Why don't you, if you can do both things, why don't you try to figure out your verbiage, and then we'll come back to that.
We'll work on this,
Mr. Chairman. I'd like to get the drafter to
but see that
correctly.
Okay, but you had time to do that. That's what I mean. But we've had that's.
I got this today.
House Bill 180, the one we've had for a month.
No, I got this thing from you guys today. The this summary from and all.
You're saying the summary from the Division of Workers' Compensation you received today, but I'm saying all of the committee members, for Representative Roper, am I correct? We've had this bill for 6 weeks. So I'm just saying I haven't seen any amendments. What you're saying is now, as we're going through each amendment, you're not willing to give it to me now. You're saying give me another through the weekend and in the next week to bring drafts of amendments. And that's frustrating because to me it may not be purposeful, but it's delaying the bill unreasonably. Representative Lynn.
The whole purpose of the committee discussion is to hear testimony from experts and to hear discussion within the committee.
Correct.
And that's why we had the committee process.
Correct.
Because I think it helps all of us focus our ideas better, which is why we have committees.
Correct.
And so, yes, I think I would assume people have looked at this bill on this committee. That's a job we have. But we've not had this come up until now in a committee setting where we hear various points of view and we hear various testimony.
Okay.
Does in response, that make sense, Mr. Chairman?
It makes sense what Thank you're you. Saying, but my response to that is we've had public hearing with three different instances where there's been a public hearing. I've closed public hearing. This isn't opinion. This is the division director giving us a step-by-step analysis, which you and your staff should have done weeks ago, since this bill has been in our committee for a month. So, with that being said, Representative Roper,
Mr. Chairman, I would just make the comment that. If somebody wants to advocate for this, and if it's such a major issue, then it should have been dealt with, and apparently it wasn't even dealt with in the ad hoc bill that was proposed to the legislature. So if the WCCA system is going to work, and that these are burning issues, then why wasn't this brought out before in any testimony or in the bill or anything else? And that's what I would like to understand that. Because if there's a real desire to cooperate and move legislation, then these issues should have been brought before the legislature previously. And that's what I'd like to see, and that's what we're trying to do now, is make sure that we can make progress and accommodate everybody's wishes.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have brought this up before in last year's deliberations. It's still an issue with me, and I wanted to ask the question if the language as it's written here now covered what I wanted to ask Director Lysanky if the way it was written this year actually gave him the power. He told me no. I'm ready to make an amendment, not right at this minute, because I'd like to have it written correctly. But if you want to forge ahead, I mean, you're the chair. You get to do that. I'm just, you said you wanted to go through the bill and listen to people's concerns. That was my concern.
And I appreciate your concern, and I think you've been very succinct in your concern, and I realize and recognize where you want to amend. What I prefer to do as a matter of time is to try to amend it today. Sounds like the whole committee supports what you're saying, rather than wait for 3 days for bill drafting to come back with an amendment. And so,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roford. And we've been on one section for 45 minutes.
Can't we move along here? I mean, I'd prefer to move along and ask. We're not going to get this whole. We're not going to wade through this thing all by today, anyway.
So. Agreed. So what we'll do is let's go on to Section 22. Actually, Paul, Section 21, that second part, it states page 17. Why don't you address that, the $1,000 per day fine?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is an adjunct to. Give us a tool to get the attention of some employers who prefer to pick up their insurance only when they've been detected. And right now, all we can do is go to the board and ask the board to issue a stop order to make them cease operating. And in the period between detection and getting such a hearing and an order. It is not atypical for someone to go get some insurance, and when the hearing date comes up, wave it in front of us and say, well, I have insurance. You can't shut me down because I have it now. So this is to address that and say, fine, you may have insurance now, but we found out that you were uninsured for a period of time, and you're facing a fine of up to $1,000 per day per uncovered employee.
And is that page 17, subsection F? That would be lines 9 through 15?
Yes.
Okay. Do any of the committee members have a question or concern on that subsection?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roper.
I would like to know that those members of this committee or members of organized labor, if they have any problems with Section 21 the way it's written. I appreciate what Representative Crawford has said. It doesn't satisfy himself by going far enough, and I appreciate that and understand that. But what we need to do to make progress is to understand that if you've got any problem with that language, as it is now. I mean, I can't understand why anybody would object. This is the most favorable thing to a worker I've seen in a major progress.
You beat me to the question because
I can appreciate
21.
Also Representative Crawford's position about wanting to add to it. But we need to know if this is okay. We're never going to make any progress unless we get some consensus here.
And Representative Roper, that's what I was going to ask, because we've gone through the substantive subsections and the entire section of 21. Other than wanting to add something to it, which again, it sounds like we have a consensus, we agree with Representative Crawford, whether this be the section or not, does anyone have a problem with Section 21 the way it's currently written? Representative Guttenberg. And if you do, then tell me where to change it.
Mr. Chair.
45 minutes on this section.
I'm just concerned that we need to ask questions. We can go through the whole section, just say anybody has a problem with Section 1, Section 2, Section 3. I'd like to ask questions. I thought that this was where we were designed to ask those questions.
This is?
Okay.
For sure. On Section 21, just so we can understand.
How does this compare with what's currently in statute?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, Section 21, as far as the fine provision, there is no fine provision currently for not having the insurance that we can get at the administrative level. The only fine is right now a criminal fine that requires a criminal proceeding, which is, as everybody is well aware, is a much more difficult thing to get accomplished.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you.
Okay. So, is there any other concern about currently Section 21 as written? Not about adding to it, but as written. So I don't hear any.
I will say it again for the record.
You're not voting for the bill. We're just going through the sections.
I think that Section 21 is wrong because it does not address misclassification, because as far as I'm concerned, that's tantamount to not having the proper insurance, and it's cheating the honest contractors and honest companies out there that are paying the proper premium.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Roper,
can I ask Mr. Stanky, have you read the ad hoc bill?
I have, through the chair, Representative Roekberg, I have read something that appears to be a bill that I'm aware of that the ad hoc committee worked up.
Well,
yes.
Did they speak to this issue that set forth in Section 21, and or in addition to that, anything that, like what Representative Crawford was talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg, I would have to look at it again to refresh my recollection precisely, but it's very close, if not exactly the same, Section 21, as what the ad hoc committee included in their recommended bill.
Well, look at this side-by-side, and it looks like there's nothing over here in the ad hoc proposal.
Could be a different section.
Well, it's 2330-082. Oh, wait a minute. No, I got it wrong. I'm sorry. I'm wrong. I see. I got that wrong.
Okay. Well, with those objections.
It is the same then.
Okay.
Noted by Representative Crawford. I'm going to move on to Section 22. Representative Ledoux.
I guess I'd just like to say that if this is a good suggestion, then it really doesn't matter whether it's in the ad hoc one. I mean...
It is, though.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry. I misunderstood. It is in it.
Okay. Why don't we go into Section 22? We'll have
yes,
17
Chairman.
More minutes. Maybe we can do that in an hour. Yeah, Representative Cott, you have a complaint or concern?
I've got a concern that I've got people in my office at 5 o'clock. Waiting
okay, if you have to go,
around,
no problem.
But I'll hang around.
Go ahead, Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Section 22 is a corollary that's designed to receive those fines that we would have the power to enforce against uninsured employers. And those fines would be directed to a newly established benefits guarantee fund. The fund would be designed and would be permitted to use the fines that were paid into the fund to pay the actual workers' compensation benefits to injured workers whose employers were uninsured and also failed to pay. And I want to make that clear because we have no intention of giving them a free ride. The bill says that first, the uninsured employer is going to be pressed to make the payments that they're still obliged to make even though they have broken the law and not properly covered their liabilities with an insurance policy. But if pressing them is unavailing, which is something that happens more often than you might assume, and again, I would hearken back to the testimony you heard from Mr. Flock as an example, where it's been years and he's got all kinds of orders from the Workers' Compensation Board awarding him benefits, but he can't get paid. This is designed to address that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and it would authorize the fund to pay the benefits to the injured worker to make them whole, and then the fund would proceed further against the uninsured employer to attempt to recover as much money as the fund could to replenish the fund. But in the interim, it would give people like Mr. Flock or other people who were injured while working for an uninsured employer who cannot or will not pay some place to go to get the benefits and the medical treatment that they so desperately need.
Okay. Are there any questions, concerns, comments regarding Section 22? No. Representative Guttenberg.
Well, thank you for this section. My comment is outside of the ability of the legislature to appropriate any funds out there, would this be, with this fund, do you think this fund would be outside the budget sweep at the end of the year, or would this, how we do the CBR sweep and bring in all funds that are out there, then we have to reappropriate them, or is this?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I'm trying, it says that it does not lapse.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions or concerns? Representative Ledoux, then Representative Roper.
Now, this doesn't automatically, if they're guarantee to a worker who's been working for an uninsured employer, rights to workers' compensation. It would only be if there's enough money collected in the fund. Is that correct? The state's not becoming an insurer here.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you're correct. It's not a guarantee, and in fact, it's written to recognize the very real possibility that there might not be enough money in the fund at any given time.
Can I follow up
sure.
on that? So, you have any idea of how much, let's say, if this bill were in effect this last fiscal year or last calendar year, whatever, how much you would have collected?
We did take a look at it just to try and give us a rough idea of how many uninsured employers we detected and how many people worked for them, and then anyone could do the math about how many days they might be off. And I'm going through it here, and I was pretty sure that I made a brief note of it, but as is sometimes the case, my brief note.
I did see your cheesecake recipe, though, which the committee would like.
You can see how desperate I am. I try and have things at my fingertip when I'm reduced to putting things on cue cards.
I'm going to take in at ease.
But
I can get back to you if you would like and try and keep things moving along. But, for example, my recollection was the year before, there was something like 2,200 employees of the uninsured employers that we caught. So if there were 2,200 of them, you know, you can do the math about per day, per dollar. And again, the $1,000 per day is the maximum, and I think that's intended, you know, to be a sliding scale based on whether it was a one-time offender for some short period of time and inadvertent, or someone that, you know, does it a lot and has a lot of people involved.
Can I follow up?
Sure,
on that?
Representative Ledoux.
Now, how many of these uninsured employers were actually solvent companies, as opposed to fly-by-night things? I guess what I'm concerned about is this sounds like a good idea as far as the worker is concerned, but is there actually going to be enough money collected through fines to really accomplish what the intent is?
Well, Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I have no way of telling you that. If nothing else, I think it would be one more tool to making sure that we dry up this problem. I mean, what we really want to do is have no uninsured employers. We're not really interested in having a big guarantee fund.
Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, I do want to go on record saying I have some concerns about establishing this fund, not because of what its objective is, which I approve of, nor even the funding source. It's the mere existence of this fund. I wanted to go on the record to say that I don't believe this legislature or any future legislature should, if in fact this fund's established, look for other sources of funding, for example, the guarantee funds that exist in current insurance law now, to add to this fund, because I'm very concerned about that. Once you establish something, it's like the old nose under the camel's nose under the tent problem. Once this is established, there's a convenient fund. There's then a crying demand because it's short, it has insufficient funds. And then there's a demand on the legislature to fund it from some source. And then clearly, the lesser of evils is not the general fund, but it's some other insurance guarantee fund that happens to be out there in the breeze. So it's a concern I have. We used it in the Fremont case. So I guess I have some problems with that in that respect. And I just want to put that on the record that I'd have a concern about this because of that.
Okay. Anyone else with a concern or comment? Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the practices that seems to happen a lot, especially amongst small contractors, is that they go out and hire extra help and then tell those people that they hire on temporarily to get their own business license, and they call themselves an independent self-employed contractor. Then they get hurt. What has happened in the past is then they actually get defined as a worker, employee, and would this, as you're envisioning it, cover those people when there's not an insurance company to go to? I mean, a pocket to go after when these people do get hurt?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, if I understand your question correctly, the supposed independent contractor who is now hurt and is found to be actually an employee would have rights to recover their benefits against the company that told them to get the license, if you will. So if that company that gave them that poor advice, if they had workers' compensation insurance, they would be covered. If they did not, then they would be an injured worker who didn't have recourse against an insured employer.
Okay. what I was thinking about at the moment was when those general contractors that like Century Construction, once that happened to them, they went away. They left the state. They were insolvent or whatever, and the guy was left without insurance. And I was kind of direct me or that was the example I was thinking of. Also, if they weren't ruled as an employee, but they were still hurt, what would happen to them?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, if they made an assertion that they were not really an independent contractor or sole proprietor, but were really an employee, and in assuming, for the purposes of your question, that it would typically go to the Workers' Compensation Board. If the board says no, you were properly characterized as an independent contractor, you know, sole proprietor, then under the current statutes, either they have to get their own insurance at their option. I mean, they're allowed to get workers' compensation insurance, but they're not required to. So it would come down to if they got their own workers' comp coverage when they got that business license, then they're fine. If they didn't, they would be without recourse legally because they chose to just take their chances.
Representative Roper, then Guttenberg.
Mr. Chairman, on page 18, line 4, said that the amounts in the fund may be appropriate for claims against the fund, for expenses directly related to fund operations and claims, and for legal expenses. I guess I have a little bit of heartburn here saying that if we have this fund to pay claims to workers who have been injured, that we're going to be paying legal expenses also. I'm not sure. It may have been that the drafting was to cover the legal expenses of the fund itself operation, but that needs to be clear that hopefully we're not paying lawyers here when we have a minimal amount of money, presumably, and we should be paying their medical and retraining and other expenses under the law. Is that, I'd like a response to that.
Through the chair, Representative Rookberg, your understanding is correct. That the drafting was done with the intention of paying the legal expenses of administering the claim, you know, for potentially defending a claim or administering a claim. It wasn't intended to be legal expenses for anybody outside the, you know, it was the fund's legal expenses, not somebody else's. If you feel that that needs clarification to make that better, I mean, you know, that may be a point well taken.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg, then Ledoux.
Thank you. I'll save my question for the end of the section.
Okay, Representative Ledoux.
Well, then what would happen if this is only legal expenses with respect to the fund's legal expenses? I see that in section F, I think, that there's a person that the fund can hire to adjust claims against the fund. Well, I guess it's my understanding that in workers' comp law as it stands now, if a claim is controverted, then if there is a lawyer hired at the end of the day, the insured pays those attorney's fees for that attorney. Well, if this doesn't allow the payment of any attorney's fees at the end of the day, does that mean that a claim which is controverted by the fund, that somebody wouldn't be able to hire an attorney because attorneys have to like to eat too?
Well, through the chair, Representative Ledoux.
The representative very hungry.
I understand your point, but I think the concern was there's only so much good you can do with a limited amount of money, and I'm not sure that when we were drafting this that it was our expectation that we would not only put together a fund that would try and pay benefits to someone who would otherwise get nothing, that we would also be inclined to pay for them to hire an attorney to make sure that they get what they want. But I think that's just the way we're thinking at the time.
But you do see the problem there, that unless you're going to say yes on every claim, that there are going to be claims that are controverted, some controverted correctly, others controverted not correctly, and there'd be no recourse then for somebody who has a claim that's been controverted if you don't allow any attorney's fees in this.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think our expectation was that there wouldn't be anybody sitting in a chair representing this benefits guarantee fund that would have any impetus to do anything except pay what they thought was the legitimate entitlement of that person. And if that person disagreed with their analysis, I mean, certainly I would agree with you that someone could say, well, I don't care that you're the guarantee fund, I still think you owe me more money. And they might even want to hire an attorney to make that point. But I don't think when we drafted it that our intention was to be so magnanimous that we would say, well, just on the chance that you may think you're being denied a benefit by this guarantee fund that's only there to try and help you, we're also going to guarantee your attorney's fees. I mean,
can I just follow up on that?
Question.
The problem with that, though, is that I think the workers' compensation law makes it a crime for an attorney to take funds from a private claimant so that they have to get their fees from the insurance company, or in this case, the fund, because somebody can't just walk into somebody's office and say, I'll pay you X dollars to represent me in a workers' compensation claim. I think that's illegal, and the Ms. Hall could probably answer.
Well, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it's illegal to take money to represent someone in the workers' compensation arena without prior approval from the board. It's not illegal for someone to pay if the board stamps okay.
Okay, we'll go to Representative, was it Guttenberg? Did you? Anyone else? This is one, Representative Cotton. Before you go, Cott, that I want you to think about an amendment or something that you want to change on this as we move ahead, because it sounds like there's some concern with that. And if you have ideas, think about them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some similar minimal concerns as Representative Roepberg. In Paul line, the first top of the page of line 18, where it says the department may deposit money into the fund. Can you tell us top of the page in line 18 where it says money deposited into the fund by the department, what would that mean? And the second part of that sentence, in appropriations to the fund, I guess the second question would be, if this fund is established and the fund is insufficient to pay claims against the fund, would you envision then coming to the legislature and asking for an appropriation into the fund to cover those unpaid claims?
Through the chair, Representative Cott, that was not what I envisioned when I was assisting in drafting this part. How far that gets me or you or the legislature, I'm certainly willing to defer to your experience.
Then can you comment on what those terms might mean?
Well, if you don't have money, they have to wait.
Well,
I mean, why is the language in there then, and appropriations to the fund? What other appropriations would there be other than the civil penalties that come to however they come in? And what other appropriations would there be?
Through the chair, Representative Cott, I do not know. I can't give you a responsible answer. I will just point out, as Director Hall pointed out, reminded me that subsection E does talk about if the money deposited in the fund is insufficient at a given time to satisfy claims, the fund shall, when sufficient money has been deposited in the fund and appropriated, then satisfy unpaid claims, which gets back to an earlier question.
Yeah, but those,
but that's not
those
your
funds
question.
Could, if appropriated by the legislature, then be there. The fund would be sufficient.
And that's why.
So I'm trying to come up with some idea of what those additional appropriations might be and what types of funds would the department be depositing.
Right. And I understand your concern, but I just don't feel adequate to give you a decent
is
response, and I'll certainly follow up on that
kind of
and respond in writing to the committee see if there's a problem.
If the intent is that the legislature will from time to time make appropriations, then I think it needs to be in there. And that's what the intent is here. I think we need to state it.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg, you had said you had a wrap-up on Section 22. Obviously,
no,
there's some problems with the committee.
Well,
so
yeah. No,
when we
whole,
come back next section. Week, I'll go to the next section and we could pass this until they have a response.
Okay.
Okay. So with that, I don't think we should go any farther. I think everyone's tired. It's 5:35. We have a meeting on Monday, same time, and we'll bring this back and continue dredging through. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, just on this point again, on this one section, in regards to Representative Ledoux's point, it seems to me that, and I'd like some feedback, and that's the reason I bring this up, from the division on this. In subsections C and D, where you are the qualifying subsections for anybody to make a claim on the fund, you have rights of subrogation, you have rights of claims, and even the fund may assert the same defenses as an insured employer under STRAPA. So the fund itself is taking up, they're subrogating the rights of the claimant, and they're also in this position to assert the same defenses as the employer to deny a claim. So how can the claimant not have some, be have access to legal counsel, I guess, if that were the case? I guess that's the dilemma I got, because I don't think this fund's going to be awful tight of money, and therefore I'm not real excited about paying legal expenses. But on the other hand, if these are the elements to qualify for the fund, and you're going to assert some of these issues against the claimant, then how can you deny legal counsel, I guess?
You get the point, don't you?
Yeah.
Will you do
question.
Some research?
You don't have to answer right now.
Representative Crawford?
That was too quick, and I couldn't hear him, and I just lost you. But if you could explain it to me after the committee meeting, I
kind of half agreeing with Representative Ledoux here.
Yeah, but I couldn't hear all you said, and I...
Well, it's trying to protect workers, Harry.
Okay. I was sure you were.
Labor and Commerce Senate will adjourn at 5:35.